Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
We're back today with another episode of Viet History Makers with my co-host, Kevin Pham.
Good to be back. For those who don't know me, my name's Kevin. I'm an assistant professor of political theory at the University of Amsterdam.
We are going to go over Phan Chu Trinh, also known as Phan Châu Trinh, and I think Kevin will get into it. And we covered somebody named Phan Bội Châu, which was our first episode together. And I asked Kevin's permission if I could describe the two Phans in this way. The first Phan that we talked about was Phan Bội Châu, and he's sort of like the Malcolm X. You know, he was into violence. He was into do whatever it takes to get the French out. And Phan Chu Trinh, to me, is more of a, you know, a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King. He believed in nonviolence. He believed in education, reform, moving the masses in a way that's not as, not as bloody and violent, and using intellectual thought to kind of move along. I was reading your book, Kevin, and, you know, to do some research about Phan Chu Trinh. I didn't understand much about him. So I came across a page that says the two Phans. They were in Japan at the same time together. And this is what Phan Chu Trinh said or wrote to Phan Bội Châu. And I found this interesting because it ties in Maddox today with Phan Chu Trinh and his relationship to Phan Bội Châu in history. The level of their people is so high. He's talking about the Japanese. And the level of our people is so low. He's talking about the Vietnamese. How could we not become slaves that some students now can enter Japanese schools and has been your great achievement? Please stay on in Tokyo to take a quiet rest and devote yourself to writing, not to making appeals for combat against the French. You should only call for popular rights and popular enlightenment. Once popular rights have been achieved, then we can think about other things. I mean, that's what a great way to kick off the episode here, because we can get some context.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great that you started with that quote, because he's talking to Phan Bội Châu. He's telling Phan Bội Châu to stay in Japan, to write, to focus on transforming the ideas of Vietnamese people before calling for violence. So one thing to say about Phan Bội Châu and Phan Chu Trinh, and I'm glad that you made this Malcolm X and Gandhi, Martin Luther King comparison, because they did differ in terms of their preferred methods. Phan Bội Châu preferred violence. Phan Chu Trinh was more of a non-violence kind of guy. And I also like the Malcolm X comparison, because Malcolm X kind of transforms throughout his life. He kind of changes after his pilgrimage to Mecca. Same with Phan Bội Châu. He kind of changes afterwards as well. Now, when we talk about Phan Chu Trinh, we often hear him mentioned alongside Phan Bội Châu. So Phan Bội Châu and Phan Chu Trinh are pioneering nationalists. They are the first to bring this idea of patriotism to Vietnam. And we really see that in their writing. So we'll talk about that today. But one really important thing to know about Phan Chu Trinh and why he's so significant is because he's the first Vietnamese person to introduce the idea of democracy to Vietnam. And yeah.
And hence, you know, I think there is sort of a raging debate amongst my, you know, my circles and my friends. You know, there's levels to democracy. And I think that's this one of the key things that we can discuss today. You know, what are we looking at here? Democracy, and what does that really mean as the West defines it, and perhaps as Fan Chuqing understands it to be or wants it to be? Because I think we can't discount this idea that we come from a Confucian culture, and there's hierarchies, there's all kinds of stipulations that are built into this culture that we sometimes from the West, we neglect to discuss the nuance.
Yeah. So today is going to be very much more of an ideas episode, because Fan Chuqin is someone who loved ideas. Democracy is an idea. Confucianism is an idea. What do those terms mean? They actually mean very different things to different groups of people. So Fan Chuqin is still celebrated today in Vietnam. I was just at his memorial. There's a museum dedicated to Fan Chuqin in Ho Chi Minh City. And by the way, Fan Chuqin is also called Fan Chuqin, as we had mentioned, but I think we're going to stick with Fan Chuqin just to be, I don't know, simple. So let's dive into it. Should I give a really brief bio?
Yeah, I mean, I have so many questions that I've prepared, but yeah, let's hear the brief bio and then we'll go into attack mode.
Is it okay for me to ask you, Ken, because, you know, what we're doing here is I'm the professor, you're the student. And usually what I would do at the beginning of class is kind of get a sense of where people are at in terms of their thinking. Let me ask you, Ken.
Honestly, I love it. I love it when you do this, and I wish you would do it more.
So Ken, here's perhaps a deceptively simple question. Is democracy good for Vietnam? What do you think?
I think it's a very complex question. And I think that what kind of democracy are we talking about? Are we talking about like full freedoms? Are we talking about, you know, human rights? What are we talking about when it comes to democracy? I think there's so many forms of it that I don't feel like I am well informed enough to answer that question. And that is why we're here, because that frankly scares me, because I've heard different versions of what Vietnam should be practicing. And I don't think it's the version of American democracy that we're talking about.
You're totally right that democracy has different interpretations. It's what political theorists call a contested concept, meaning that people with different ideologies claim onto it. And they say, we are promoting democracy. If you look at the writings of Ho Chi Minh, he will always say, we are for democracy, and the battle is between democracy and capitalist imperialists. That is the battle.
So that has so, I mean, if you think about what he's saying and what you think of modern day Vietnam's government, it's kind of very far removed, right? Because is it a true democracy that Vietnam is in right now? I mean, that can be heavily contested.
It's a contested term. So for example, my uncles who fought for the South Vietnamese, when I remember being 8 years old and I asked them, why were you guys fighting? And he said a very simple answer. He said, it was a fight between democracy and tyranny. And of course, his side was the democracy. So you have both sides claiming that they're fighting for democracy. So we're going to talk more about what Fan Chuqin meant by democracy in this episode. So let's jump into the bio. Fan Chuqin was born in 1872 in Guangnam province, and he died in 1926 when he was about 53. When he was 15 years old, his father was killed, allegedly by members of the Gan Vung movement. So we talked about them in the episode on Phan Boi Châu, because the movement suspected that his father was working against them. But I bring that up because maybe that's where he begins to get his anti-violence, you know, disposition. But he trained in the martial arts, interestingly, when he was young, and later in the literary arts by Confucian scholars. So he studied Confucian classics, and his favorite texts to read were The Analects of Confucius, which is a book of sayings and quotes by Confucius and his disciples. So it's kind of a book of dialogues between Confucius and his students, and also the Mencius. And in 1900 and 1901, he received degrees for passing the Mandarin exams. We had also talked about that. Back in those times, if you were a Vietnamese male, your goal was to do really well on the exams, the Mandarin exams, to serve in government. And in 1903, he went to Hue. He served as a secretary in the Ministry of Rites. So that's the part of the government where they organize state exams, state ceremonies, things like that. And around this time, he's also reading about European thinkers through Chinese translations. So he's getting his ideas of the West through Chinese writings. And according to some stories, he was so fascinated by these writings of European thinkers that he would forget to eat and sleep. That also tells you how Confucian he is, because I believe there's also a quote where Confucius is so in love with learning that he forgets to eat and sleep. So he's kind of channeling.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's funny because that is actually a Vietnamese adage, you know, mei wa wan an wan ngo, right?
Yeah.
So that's something that Vietnamese people we actually say quite a bit.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's perfectly fitting here. It's also very Confucian. So in 1904, he decides to leave his secretary position because, and I'm going to quote him, he says, one cannot just sit in a corner and talk about things in the outside world, especially in the present state of affairs, when the winds of change are blowing in all directions. So one must go and look to see what's happening. So there you go. He says, we can't just sit here. We need to see what's happening in the world. Therefore, he arrives in Japan in 1906, where he meets with Fanboy Cho. And in 1907...
Can I stop you real quick there? Was it a coordinated thing? They both said, okay, you know, we're going to pack up and go to Japan and meet there. Or did they just casually run into each other in some Vietnamese delegation?
No, they planned to go there together. They planned to go there together to meet there. Yeah, it wasn't just random. But at the same time, this whole movement to go there. Yeah. So okay. In 1907, he writes a letter, and this is a famous letter, to the Governor General of Indochina, so a Frenchman, named Paul Bo. And in this letter, Phan Chu Trinh scolds the colonial regime for what? Any guesses, Ken? He's writing a letter criticizing the colonial regime for what? Can you guess?
My first guess would be for collecting taxes on the Vietnamese people.
So actually, his main emphasis for why he was criticizing the colonial regime is because the regime gave too much freedom to corrupt Vietnamese mandarins.
Interesting.
You know, this really tells you that his biggest issue at the time seemed to be not so much colonialism, but rather the corrupt Vietnamese mandarins and the system of monarchy that Vietnam had. Now, to be sure, he does demand changes in colonial policy. He does criticize colonialism, but his greater emphasis was on the corrupt Vietnamese mandarins. So that's 1907. And in that year, he also inspires the creation of the Tonkin Free School in Hanoi, the Dong Kinh Nghĩa Thuật. So we briefly talked about that in another episode as well. And around this time, he also creates a company, apparently, to process cinnamon trees because he believed the Vietnamese should be entrepreneurs in business to modernize Vietnam. He kind of promoted business. And in 1908, the Tonkin Free School is shut down by colonial authorities. It only lasts for barely a year. because they were accused of engaging in anti-colonial activity. You know, who are these students learning about ideas from the West? What are they doing? They're arrested. The people who create the school are arrested. He is also arrested during this. And he's sentenced to life imprisonment on Gondao Island. However, a Frenchman intervenes and reduces his sentence. And Fan Chuchun was released in 1910. Then in 1911, he goes to Paris, where he stays for 14 years. He's there for 14 years until 1925. And while in Paris, he stays in touch with other Vietnamese who are there. For example, he stays in touch with the person who would become Ho Chi Minh. And in 1914, he was jailed while he was in Paris because the French thought he was trying to get help from the Germans to fight the French. In 1919, Ho Chi Minh and Phan Van Chung put together a list of demands for the delegates of the Paris Peace Conference, where, you know, these great powers are coming together after the end of World War I. They're trying to figure out a new world order, and Ho Chi Minh delivers this list of demands, which was written probably by Phan Van Chung, who's a lawyer, but also by Phan Chuchun. And hopefully we'll talk more about that list of demands in other episodes, but or maybe in this one, because it's really important, but I'll get back to that later. So moving on, in 1925, he returns to Vietnam and he gives two really important speeches in November after he returns. One is called Morality and Ethics in the Orient and in the Occident, and the other is called Monarchy and Democracy. And I'll say more about that. But then he dies a few months later in 1926, natural causes. And what's interesting here is that his funeral was really the first national funeral. Apparently tens of thousands, or maybe I've even seen hundreds of thousands, people are going into the streets to protest the end of colonial rule. And just his funeral kind of brings everybody together. So anyway, that's a really quick bio.
You know, what's incredible listening to this bio is oftentimes when I was a kid, I thought that history only happened when I was born, right? It's such an egotistical thing. But as a kid, you don't have any sort of reference to what happened before you were born. So you think, oh, when I came out into the world, I was, you know, history started. And then it progressed into weirder kind of like thinking as a sort of going into my teenager or adult years, thinking that the Vietnamese people, the modern history, really started with my mom and dad, right? Mm-hmm. And their stories and their friends and families that you would sit around and listen to at the dinner table or the ban nhau with your dad and his friends. So I'd always thought that very naively that we sort of was the point of start of the Vietnamese modern history. And I never had a chance because we didn't grow up in Vietnamese schools to be exposed to these figures. And now we are beginning to uncover, I am beginning to uncover the history of, you know, the first national sort of mourning of these people that really had powerful thought in the 20s, in the 1920s. And we are way down the road as modern people living abroad and, you know, going back to our homeland often, that there's a really rich tapestry of thinkers, political theorists that really laid the tracks down for where we are today in Vietnam and abroad.
And I love that imagery of a tapestry because a tapestry has different strands. And you can't really appreciate the individual strands, but together they make up a mosaic, an image, a story, right? And so these figures that we're looking at, Phan Boi Châu, Bao Dai, Phan Chu Chin, they all contribute to this tapestry, this image of Vietnam. So I like that. So, yeah, did you want to add?
No, I have questions on questions, but go ahead, Kevin.
Well, one thing I think is a good place to start is simply with Phan Chu Chin's motivation, What was he motivated by and what was he trying to do? The short answer of this is, number one, he was trying to explain how the Vietnamese people could be conquered by the French. That's the first question. How did we Vietnamese people get conquered by the French? Now, if I ask anybody, how does conquest happen? How does colonialism happen? What would your first answer be? Like, how can people get conquered?
I think in those days, without media, without mass media, without social media, I think that there is a hegemonic difference. There's a bigger power and a lower power. I think there's a power that comes in with more money, more riches, more knowledge, more technological warfare, that it's easy to kind of manipulate the class of the country that doesn't understand anything. I mean, if you think about it, we didn't have much at the time in terms of weapons and really manipulation, psychological manipulation, mass psychological manipulation to really own a country. And I think that France had been doing it for hundreds of years. Europe has been doing this for hundreds of years. And they understood the system. And they go into this foreign place and these people are like a piece of white paper. They're blank papers and they don't know anything. And they see this, you know, the way the French are carrying themselves, and they think that the system that the French bring in is much more superior than their own class and culture. And I think that's how it gets taken over.
Okay, great. And that really does overlap with Phan Chu Trinh's answer as well. But let me ask you another follow-up question. So Ken, you said that, okay, the Vietnamese didn't have as powerful weapons as the French. How would you explain that? Why didn't the Vietnamese have this technology of weapons and the power of a state like the French? How would you answer that?
I think there's a few things that come to my mind initially. That's a great question, by the way. I think that France, with the history of taking over so many places and colonizing so many places, they've been able to acquire gold and treasure and money to really finance their wars. I think Vietnam didn't have that. Vietnam didn't have any of that lined up. They didn't perhaps have the history of lining up gold to transfer that over to power, weaponry. And I think that as France, their war machines with their generals and with their battle plans, their technology into taking over territory and using very few people, soldiers and you know, people on the ground to secure an entire city or entire villages was a very easy thing for the French to do.
Okay, so in short, your answer would be, well, France had experience in war making, and therefore they became more powerful in terms of technology and weaponry, whereas the Vietnamese did not have that experience. That's why they were weaker.
Yeah, that's my guess.
Okay. Phan Chu Trinh gave a very different answer. So his answer for why the Vietnamese were indeed weaker politically, economically, technologically, the reason why the Vietnamese were weaker is because of Vietnam's history of monarchies. Vietnam had a history of autocratic dictators, basically, despots who had kept the people ignorant of true Confucianism. And because the people did not understand genuine, authentic Confucian morality and ethics, they became weak. And therefore, they became vulnerable to foreign conquest. So, does that surprise you?
Not really. It doesn't surprise me. I think that's a very simplistic answer. I think for the time, I think he's not sort of admitting true weakness in terms of weaponry and technology to conquer.
But the thing though is that for him and for many other Vietnamese at the time, technological advancement, that requires a kind of spirit of wanting to learn, wanting to be exposed to new ideas. And that's what the Vietnamese people were lacking, according to many of them. So I'm just going to read a few quotes here from him. He says, "Our country was weak, Therefore, it fell into the hands of the French. And this weakness, he argues, was a result of Vietnam's lack of a solid moral foundation upon which everything else depends. So he says, from time immemorial, regardless of the country, regardless of the race, a nation had to rely on morality as its foundation. For a nation that has fallen down, in order to rise up and avoid being trampled over by others, it's all the more necessary to have a moral foundation even firmer than that of wealthier and stronger nations. So here I want to dive into what he means by this. What he means by morality, so in Vietnamese, đạo đức, morality, is that it's something that never changes. It's something that's always the same anywhere, anytime, any place, and it's universal. And it just so happens that Confucius propagated morality, and it's universal and true, not because Confucius said it, but because it's universal and true. Confucius happened to say it, and any other nation's great thinkers, if they're smart enough, can figure out what Confucius also figured out. So that's morality. It's something that never changes. But then on the other hand, you have what Fan Chu Trinh calls ethics, luân lý. Ethics can change, and it does change with the times. It varies from place to place. So I'm going to quote him again. He says, to be a human being, one is expected to have nhân, meaning humaneness, nghĩa, righteousness, lễ, propriety, chí, wisdom, tín, trustworthiness, gần, diligence, and kiềm, frugality. So if listeners haven't noticed, if they know anything about Confucianism, these are basically some of the Confucian virtues here. He's kind of just repeating Confucian ethics here, morality. So ethical relations can change, and what he means by that is that the ethical relations between ruler and ruled can change, for example. In Confucianism, there are five relationships, ruler and ruled, husband, wife, friend, you know, that kind of thing. But he says that kind of stuff can change, but the morality always stays the same. And this is important to understand about his ideas, because later he's basically going to say that if ethics can change, that means we should change to a democracy. And our morality will stay the same, but the ethics need to change. So let me just finish this kind of explanation of why he thinks the Vietnamese were conquered by the French. So number one, the Vietnamese were weak and the French were strong. And the Vietnamese were weak because they were ignorant of authentic Confucianism. And the reason for that is because despotic rulers and corrupt mandarins had deliberately misinterpreted Confucianism to justify their despotism, their oppression. So basically, they tricked the Vietnamese people into thinking that it was Confucian to obey rulers blindly. And therefore, the people got used to being submissive. They never questioned, they never talked back, they kind of just nodded their heads to the autocrats. And what this produced was a lack of patriotism, a lack of nationalism. So I'm going to quote him again. He says, the people, the Vietnamese people, understand if someone tells them, you must be loyal to this person, you must respect that person. But if someone mentions the name of Vietnam and tells them that's your motherland, you must love it, they don't understand because they cannot touch it with their hands or see it with their eyes. So he's criticizing the Vietnamese people for not having in their minds an idea of Vietnam. All they understand is their village life. The Vietnamese will gossip if a family has children who are addicted to gambling. But, quote, if one talks about the loss of national independence, not a single soul cares. And he says, the poison of autocracy has fatally injured the patriotism of our people.
This is really complex theory at the time. When I think back, I am blown away by this person's perceptions, this person's observation about society and understanding the dynamics. And what's even more impressive is his crossover into modern thinking and this idea that, okay, we have this real deal Confucian sort of way of looking at life, but now I am going to introduce you into this Western way of of looking at it so we don't stay slaves to this people.
Right.
It's mind-blowing.
And it's important to keep in mind that he thinks that Confucianism, its morality that it teaches, is pure and true. It's just that the Vietnamese never knew it. They've always learned a corrupt version of it. And so he says, he's looking around and he's like, why doesn't anybody care that our country is being enslaved by the French? Oh, I notice that these people don't care because they've been trained to be submissive. Why is that? It's because the monarchy, the history of monarchy. So then he looks abroad and he says, okay, look at other Confucian nations. Look at Japan. They had Confucianism. Why did they modernize and why didn't we? Here's the answer, he says. Because their kings, their leaders, were open to learning from the West. And then Phan Chu Chen points to all these Vietnamese emperors who refused to learn from the West. They were kind of just arrogant. They didn't want to care about the outside world. So Phan Chu Chen is going to say, we need to look outward to Europe and to learn. So what he does is he turns to what he calls Western ethics. And keep in mind, he's coming back from 14 years in France. And so he's basically explaining to the people, here's what I saw. And he says, in Europe, I saw that people cared about their families, but they moved beyond that to care about the nation. So Europeans also had monarchs in the past, just like in Vietnam, monarchs who were oppressive, who justified their rule by appealing to divine power. But in Europe, you had philosophers who wrote books and helped the people understand the importance of the nation, understand the importance of freedom and rights and laws. And so he says, Europeans, I'm going to quote him, compete only within the law. They help one another with respect to public justice and maintain a sense of respect for each other's interests. In contrast, it's a shame that our people, though having to work throughout their lives, cannot look after their basic personal needs and prepare for their old age, let alone think of society or humanity. How could we not respect the Europeans if they're so superior to us? What's your reaction?
Scalding. That's scalding. It's true. There's a lot of truth to that. It's just, when I think about it, it's just a sadness to think about the evolution of societies. And, you know, I think at that time, Vietnam was just really behind in their way of thinking. And I don't disagree with him when he says it's really the monarchy's fault. You know, and I think when you think about Japan, Korea, you think about these other Asian countries that modernized alongside with whoever their monarchs were, because they had kings and prime ministers and presidents all happening just like they did in Europe with... When I think about Britain, I think France probably was not part of that model. They got rid of their monarchy and then they switched over into a full like government mode without the monarchs. But I think Britain did something very beautiful. They developed beyond their monarchy but they kept their queen and their kings alongside their parliament and their governing bodies. And I think Vietnam was just purely, we're going to hold on to power. Again, no media, no mass media, no social media. So I don't think people understood that the general people of Vietnam understood that there's a different way to do this.
Yeah, yeah. So the core point that we want to get across here is that for Phan Chu Chen, the main problem is monarchy. It's the history of monarchy. It's kept people ignorant, lazy, unpatriotic. So what's the solution? Well, it's the opposite of a monarchy. And we have a few words for this. One would be democracy. So instead of one person in ruling, it's every citizen who participates in that rule. We might also call it a republic. So republic comes from the word res publica, meaning the public thing. So power of the state should lie in the public. So of course, democracies can be a form of a republic. And there's another, so those are forms of government, democracy, republic, but there's also an ideology here. And that ideology, I think the best word for it would be liberalism. Liberalism. And when we political theorists talk about liberalism, we're referring to what we would call classical liberalism, which is an ideology centered on individual freedom. And for Fan Chuqin, he uses this term, du zao. It kind of literally translates to thoughts.
Individual thoughts.
Well, yeah, thoughts of freedom, du zao, right? Freedom, du zao. Thoughts of freedom. And in the West, when we think of liberalism, we think of individual freedom. So liberals, and I'm talking about classical liberals, I'm not talking about in the United States where people on the left are referred to as liberal, but in classical liberalism, you favor individual freedom. You would want a minimal government, a small government, to allow for individual freedom. You want a free market. You want laws to defend individual freedoms. That's classical liberalism. Now, what I want to suggest is that Fan Chuqin is going to use this term liberalism, but he means it in a different way from the classical liberalism. He's not going to emphasize individual rights. Instead, he's going to emphasize popular rights. So he's always talking about zhen guin, like popular rights, the rights of, for the people, zhen guin. And so this entails free speech, freedom to criticize, but it's not so much this liberal individualism where each individual, you know, should be left alone. It's not that kind of style. It's a different kind of liberalism. So I'm going to read a quote. He's talking about what he saw in Paris, and he says, "Along its long boulevards and in the large public squares, you must have seen the bronze statues commemorating the philosophers and the heroes who risked their lives in defense of freedom. You must have seen the pillar that reaches up into the clouds. Atop it stands a goddess who holds in her hand the flame of liberty radiating in four directions. That is the goddess of liberty who illuminates the whole world and has no mercy for any tyrant monarch on earth." That's what he sees in France. And so democracy is the form of government that comes from liberalism, he thinks. So if the Vietnamese knew what democracy was, they would realize that it's okay to get rid of kings if they do a bad job. And then he kind of explains to the Vietnamese the political systems in Europe. So he explains, here's what checks and balances are. Here's what a president does. He must take an oath not to betray the people. And look, they have a national assembly. Here's how the Senate is elected, et cetera, et cetera. And he's basically going to say, if we Vietnamese adopt democracy, it would actually enhance Confucianism for us. Because the Europeans, whether they know it or not, they're better Confucians than us because they have morality. And we have forgotten that. So by bringing in liberalism and democracy, we will actually enhance Confucian ideas of self-improvement in Vietnam. For a political theorist, this is really bizarre to read because in political theory literature, it's quite clear there's a consensus that Confucianism and liberalism are just opposed because Confucianism sees society as a gigantic family where we have duties towards each other. And liberalism sees society as a social contract between consenting individuals who are supposed to leave each other alone, right? So that there's a clash there. But what he's saying is that liberalism will actually bring back Confucianism to Vietnam. And that, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, and I think what he's, the commentary that he is really kind of exposing is Confucianism in its purest form is not being practiced correctly.
Yes.
And perhaps these guys in Europe are doing it right because, you know, it seems to work because the respect and the real understanding of and benefiting each other in a society is at its highest point at that time.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is sort of the core of his theory here, that if Vietnam wants to stand on its own feet, it needs to develop a spirit of nationalism, of patriotism, and also care towards its own people. And the thing that's going to do that is democracy.
Okay. I now want to ask you that because this it's just on my mind for the last 15 minutes. We might have to define what democracy in its different shades and tones perhaps might mean. throughout history, today, contemporary, modern? What are we defining as democracy, and how is it being applied in America versus Vietnam?
I love this question. You've asked the right person, as someone who studies political ideology. So let's start with the word itself, democracy. The word demos comes from Greek, and it simply means the people. And when you add an ocracy to something, it means rule. So literally, you have the words people, rule. So it's people rule. And it develops in ancient Greece, interestingly, and not in ancient China. Now, there's a lot of literature here, but one potential explanation for why democracy developed in Greece and not in China, potentially, and I'm drawing on the work of my professor friend, John Lombardini, but he thinks that democracy developed in ancient Greece because the Greeks had slaves. What does that have to do with democracy? Well, in a democracy, you simply need to define who the people are. You need a boundary. Here are the people on the inside. Here are not the people outside. And in order to have a participatory democracy where people literally participate in decision-making, where they come to the public square and they debate with each other and then they vote, in order to do that, what do you need? You need free time. You need free time to study up on the current issues and debates. And if you have free time, who's going to do all the work? You need slaves to do that, right? Mm. So that's one argument for how democracy developed in Greece. Keep in mind, this was only for male citizens with property. Slaves were excluded. Women were excluded. Foreign people who were there were excluded. So when we talk about democracy, there's an image of the people. And then it becomes very interesting, like, well, what do you mean by the people? Now, this also becomes really interesting because I gave you two words, Ken, the people, well, three words, so the people and rule. Now, if you were to make a sentence with that, how would you describe democracy? Is it democracy is when the people rule, or is it rule for the people? Is it rule by the people? Is it rule of the people? So in the United States, we think of democracy as rule for the people and by the people and of the people, right? But in some Confucian societies, so there's a whole debate right now about, is democracy compatible with Confucianism? Now we need to take a step back and talk about Confucian visions of good government. So in your own mind, Ken, when you think of Confucianism, what is the ideal form of governance when it comes to Confucian thinking, just from what you know?
You know, I think when I think about Confucianism, I think about family hierarchy. I think there's a deep respect for that sort of form. In our families, we try to be highly hierarchical. We respect that sort of that form. It's kind of like a beautiful thing if it's done properly. And there's also this idea of community being stronger than the individual. And I think that's just much more apparent in Eastern Confucian societies. And so those ideas are kind of in opposition of the West. We don't believe in hierarchical, like if your grandfather says something racist in America, you're going to call him out at the Thanksgiving table. Your uncle says something that crosses the line, you're going to speak up. You have no problem doing that. And I think in Vietnam, that's not the way we operate. We don't operate that way.
So let me inquire further. There was a moment where you said, if done properly, it could be a beautiful thing, this sort of family dynamic. Can you say more, like describe what would that dynamic look like between, say, the father and the son?
Sure.
How would that look?
Sure. I think it's just human nature that when we are the older, when we're the elder, we oftentimes forget about the younger. When we're in power, we oftentimes forget about the weaker. I think it's just a human sort of trait that when you have power and it's consolidated in the family dynamic, in the father, the grandfather, the patriarch, you often forget the women. You often forget the children. You don't see, how can you? I mean, that's just the way power works, right? And I think it's the same in government. I think in the United States, it's not perfect, but I think there is a little bit more awareness that at any time, the people on the ground can raise their voice by writing into their Congress people, protesting in the streets, doing whatever it takes that the people at the top will listen. And I think that dynamic is more fluid in Western societies than it is in Eastern societies.
Okay. But to go back to the ideal Confucian family,
okay,
the ideal would be that the father remembers the son.
Exactly. That the people who are in sort of the quote unquote the higher positions has an obligation to do right. And that is difficult. And I think that's like the major downfall of Confucian society is that it doesn't trickle back up. They say crap rolls downhill. And I think that at the center of Confucian ideology is the problem. It's really a problem.
This is excellent. I think you did a really good job describing the ideal form of Confucian governance. So that's exactly right, that Confucians think that society should be ruled just like a family. In an ideal family, you have the parents who know better than their children, but are in a position to care for their children and ensure that the children have all their needs met. So an ideal society for Confucian would be that the king, the emperor, provides for the people, gives enough for the people so that the people don't have to talk about politics. The moment the people start talking about politics, you know something's going wrong because they're not being cared for. The ideal would be, there would be no talk of politics. But the problem with this way of thinking about good governance is that, well, how do you answer this question? What if the parent is bad, right? What do you do if the parent is bad? Yeah. So Fan Chuchun realized that Confucians had no good answer to that. Now, I have to be fair, however. Mencius is a disciple of, not a direct disciple, but he was a follower of Confucius. And Mencius wrote these famous passages where he said, actually, it's totally consistent in Confucian political thought to basically overthrow the king if the king is bad. Because he says that the king has a mandate of heaven, and the mandate says, well, the people must be cared for. So there's a famous passage where Mencius says, the most important thing are the people, and then much later, the king. So if it's true that the people are most important and the king is doing a bad job, well, then there's probably a right of rebellion here. However, from a Confucian perspective, it's not supposed to be the people who are supposed to rebel. They're supposed to wait for more wiser people to lead this sort of rebellion. But basically for Fan Chuchun, he knew that Confucians didn't have a good answer for what if the king is bad. So that's where democracy comes in.
There's an elephant in the room right now. We can't not say that. Look around the world. I mean, no system's perfect, but at the same time, how do you remove the word, how do you take out this idea of rebelling against your parents, rebelling against government in Vietnamese society? It's caked into, whether it was communism or whatever you wanted to call it. I always say that perhaps you can call it whatever you want, but at the end of the day, it's still going to be Confucianism. An imperfect form of rule is Confucian philosophy because of that inability for the young and the weak to have it go back up the hill.
There's something that I forgot to mention, though, which is that there is, in the tradition of Confucian ideas of governance, there's a tradition of remonstrance, meaning that you're allowed actually, and you're encouraged to gently criticize. You're encouraged to say nicely to the parents or the rulers, hey, here are my needs. They're not really being met. So that is a reason why Chinese rulers, they assembled the people often, mostly just to tell the people what decisions have already been taken, but also to kind of take the temperature and to make sure, well, what if we want to serve the people, we need to hear from them what their needs are. So there is a tradition where the people's role is maybe not to rule the society or themselves, but it is to sort of consult the ruler and to give advice to the ruler and to gently criticize. But, you know, gently and friendly criticism, not like outward rebellion.
When I go to Vietnam and when I think about Vietnam in general, and I'm just generalizing like I always do, it's not a good trait of mine, but it's hard for me not to think that when I go to Vietnam, I'm basically going to my uncle's house. And I've said this in the podcast. I'm going to my uncle's house. He has different ways of looking at his family. He has stricter guidelines. He doesn't allow certain things to happen in his house. And I respect that. I'm not going to go to his house and tell his kids, hey guys, you got to do it this way. Cause you know, where I'm from, where my family's from, we do it a different way. I don't do that. I go, I understand. This is the way that, you know, for all these years, uncle, you've been running your household that way. Now, how do I affect change in that household if I'm seeing things that I don't agree with and it feels like it's crossing the line? I don't know. And I think that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here with you. That's why I'm here with all these people throughout the world, inside Vietnam, outside of Vietnam. I just want to create dialogue to kind of understand how do we get uncle to kind of, you know, maybe look at things differently. And I don't think that uncle is that closed mind. I think he has been doing things for a long time and in a very cultural sort of, he has his own pathway. And we're kind of like this different family that comes from a different lineage.
Yeah. I think this is a really great example to illustrate this tension or this aspect of Confucian thinking where what is a good answer to what if the king is bad, right? One thing that I wanted to briefly mention, and I won't go too deep into this because this episode is not about Ho Chi Minh, but we have to mention that for Ho Chi Minh, he said he wanted democracy. And what does he mean by that? Readers, you should buy my book and read it. There's a chapter on that. But he uses this term all the time, Zan Zhu. The people, Zan, are the masters or the landlords, you know, Zhu Nya, the Zhu, right? For Ho Chi Minh, democracy meant that the people are the most important from his perspective, and the government are the servants of the people who are the masters. But at the same time, the government are like the people's parents who know better and who must guide the children towards socialism. You know, so for Ho Chi Minh and communists and Leninists, democracy kind of meant the one party in power must represent the interests of the people. So they kind of speak for the people. So they will call it a democracy. So it's not a direct democracy where the people rule, but the party rules on behalf of the people. Now, of course, do you want to say, is that really democracy? You don't have to, but again, we get to this debate about what does democracy really mean?
You know, we are nearing the end of our episode on Fan Chu Ching, and I'm perplexed at this point that these two, you know, because I'm in the dark, I'm trying to figure out, okay, well, we went over Fan Bozhou, we went over Fan Chu Ching. These two guys, these two rock stars, political idealist rock stars, they pass on. And I am really curious who picks up the baton after these two big figures. You know, I'm not saying that we should tease out whoever we're going to talk about next, but I am curious to hear sort of when two big thinkers like this pass on and their time goes by. You know, obviously, like I said in the earlier, that where does history pick itself back up? Like, who's that next guy that picks up the baton and go, you know, these two guys had really good ideas. Let's roll with this and let's do something about it.
You know, since you ask this question, I mean, there is kind of a literal answer here where at some point I wish I had the quote right in front of me, but Phan Chu Trinh writes a letter, apparently, to the young Ho Chi Minh, and he quite literally says, "I am a tired horse that can no longer gallop, and you are a fiery stallion. You need to go back to Vietnam and save the country." And so Ho Chi Minh makes his way back to Vietnam.
Sees the answer to the next.
That's what Phan Chu Trinh would have said, I think.
Yeah. Got it. Well, we will, I think, eventually reach the point where we're going to have to cover Ho Chi Minh. And I think there's a lot of hot discourse on, you know, children of the South covering Ho Chi Minh. And you know, how can we cover such a huge political figure? I mean, but we're doing the academic work. And I just hope that we can freely discuss without any sort of bias. I mean, obviously, we're going to have our own biases and we're children of the South. But, you know, in terms of having an intellectual free speech discussion, I would love to get to know all aspects of Vietnamese culture and history.
Yes. And with that said, should we give a teaser for who we're going to discuss next?
Yeah, you've brought up several times to me, and I've sort of cowered a little bit with the name, but it's not because of anything obvious, but the real big reason I would say yes to this next person, I think who you're going to mention, is because we need to start introducing women in the history of Vietnamese political thinking, and I'll give you the honors to bring her up.
Yeah, so the next person we'll discuss is a woman named Nguyen Thi Dinh, and she was the first female general of the Vietnam People's Army during the Vietnam War, first female vice president of Vietnam. I mean, this is a woman who fought for the North, you know, the communists. And so it is our first person who I think will show a different side, a different ideological side to the folks we have been discussing. So in our next episode, we're going to discuss a woman named Nguyen Thi Dinh. And Nguyen Thi Dinh was quite a big figure. She is the first female general of the Vietnam People's Army during the Vietnam War, also the first woman vice president of Vietnam. And she is on the side of the North, right? She's on the communist side. And as children of the South, Ken, you and I, we did feel that it was important in the series to show many different perspectives when it comes to Vietnam. And so we will be engaging with that perspective in the next episode.
But Kevin, can I ask you, what are our guardrails? Do we have guardrails? Because we are both children of the South. We are not, it's not a one-to-one here. You're not a children of the North, a child of the North. I'm not a child of the North. We are speaking from a very politically charged perspective. And I think, I want to know, what do you think? Well, I mean, let's talk about it openly. What are our guidelines? What are we, because I've gotten in a lot of hot waters on both sides. So I don't want anybody upset at me, even though I should not care, right? But I do care. And I do love people, Vietnamese people around the world. And I don't want anybody to feel burdened with anger. And I want people to feel like we can engage in humanity, and we can engage in figures all across the history of Vietnam, and talk about these figures, talk about the hurt, talk about the pain, talk about the suffering, talk about the good things that people have done, because not everybody could be bad and not everybody could be great.
Right. What I want to say to this is a few things. My goal as a professor, as a scholar of Vietnamese history, of Vietnamese intellectual history and political thought, my goal is simply to understand how people understand themselves and their world. And what I'm interested in is looking at people who were influential throughout Vietnamese history. And I will look at any person. Now, I do want to be sensitive and thoughtful, keeping the pain of our parents, for example, in mind. I want to be respectful of that. But I also have to say to the listener, if you don't want to listen to someone who fought for the communists, then simply you don't need to listen to the episode. Like, it's a contract here. The listener must agree that they are willing to listen to perspectives that they may disagree with. And if you don't want to, you really don't have to. But, you know, I kind of want to do this contract with my students. We will talk about perspectives that might make you upset. You don't have to engage with it. But I'm going to present it. I'm not going to take sides. That's one thing that I won't do. I'm just going to try to illuminate and shed light on different perspectives here.
I have been accused of being naive. I've been accused of being young in mind because I think that I can be inspired by our general community throughout the world to come together and to unify, and to unify in thought. We don't need to unify in the economic sense where we get together and we do business. Let's just start with the ability to have discourse. And I think that's where I start. That's where I come from. You know, we can talk about people doing good things and bad things and all in one breath, right? We can talk about that. And I think when I think about persecution and when I think about like tyranny, who do they get rid of first? They burn the books first and then they go after the academics and professors. Because when you start talking about things that are uncomfortable in, on any side, we got to kill the people who write. We got to kill the academics who think about these things because we don't want to feel uncomfortable and we want to move power in the way that we want it to move and not to illuminate for humanity the facts. Right. And I think it's something that, you know, I try to have the courage to stand and live by. Hard and though.
One thing that I'll also add though is like as an American, I mean, we have free speech enshrined in our constitution, you know, and I think that that's a blessing. Not every place in the world has that. And I think we need to take advantage of it. Another thing that I want to briefly mention is that, so I recently did an episode with Yin Vu on Nam Phong Dialogues about who is Vietnamese. What does that mean? Inspired by your question, Ken. But one of the things we say is that people are defined by their stories. Like, there's no objective definition of a British person or of an American or of a French person. These groups are really defined by the stories that they tell themselves. Now, what's interesting about what you and I are doing is that we're telling the stories that might be co-opted or used by South Vietnam or the stories that might be used by North Vietnam. But we're also just telling this big Vietnamese story from different Vietnamese perspectives. So maybe in that sense, you and I are sort of, by telling these stories, we're kind of creating a new Vietnamese person. I don't know.
Well, I mean, in the spirit of Phan Chu Trinh, we are doing what he is sort of advocating from those days of his life. We are really doing our best to illuminate different ways of thinking and maybe perhaps carve out a new pathway for people all over the Vietnamese diaspora and inside of the homeland to think about perhaps we can reframe and restructure the way we have been living as Vietnamese people. And I think it affects everything from the house, inside the house, the family structure, all the way to the way we, you know, in government all over the world.
Yeah.
Kevin, I think, you know, today that's a wrap. I really always appreciate, you know, your time and sitting here. And one more time, where can I find your book?
So the book is called The Architects of Dignity, Vietnamese Visions of Decolonization. You can get it wherever you get your books, on the Oxford University Press website or on Amazon or wherever else. Order it from your bookstore.
And I want to end today just by congratulating you. Can I congratulate you on your new life? You just got tenured yesterday. This is in Amsterdam, University of Amsterdam. And I am very proud of that accomplishment that you've done.
Thanks so much. It's really a dream that all academics strive for. With tenure, you have job security. You can do what you love. So I feel really blessed. and grateful for all those who have helped me along the way. So thank you.
Wonderful. And we will catch you in the next episode.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.